Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are very pleased to have one of the preeminent intelligence experts in the United States with us to kick this off. He is Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, a distinguished military hero, really, and leader, now retired from the United States Army. Last duty station was as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, a man I'm privileged to have been able to collaborate with on many things and consider a great friend. Jerry, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, I'm always glad to be on your program.
Thank you. Let's start with Benghazi Gate. You have been leading an effort with many of your comrades in the Special Operations Forces, past and present, to try to get an accounting for what actually happened on September 11th, 2012 in Benghazi and what led up to it and what flowed from that attack, murderous attack. We've had a report now issued by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, people you've dealt with over the years. What did you make of that report? And is there still a need for, as you've called for, a select committee to investigate and hold people accountable?
Frank, the report was encouraging, but it fell far short of what is needed to achieve accountability on this. Look, I think it's obvious that there were some compromises made between the two parties in issuing that report, in that there was no culpability identified. There was no blame. Hillary nor the president were neither one held accountable. And even though the report
hardly even mentioned, as a matter of fact, let alone held accountable.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that it confirmed what we already knew, what we had already heard. There was nothing spectacularly new in this report. It was just a confirmation of what we already knew. So I think it falls short. I think that the House Resolution 36, which Frank Wolf has been calling for over a year, is the answer to this. And I think we need to keep pressure on John Boehner and press on him to pull together a bipartisan committee with subpoena power to get into the details of this. Frank, they've never interviewed the survivors of this thing, which we know there were over 30 survivors. They've never brought them in. There are other key military people who were there during the night of the attack at the headquarters in AFRICOM and also even on the ground that have never been called in and asked what the military's response was or what instructions the military was issued with regards to a response. So that's important.
Yeah. General Boykin, you've got a lot of experience in these things. Were you surprised at the finding of this Select Committee on Intelligence that there really were no military options available and that therefore when nothing was done to try to help these folks, it was, if not exactly excusable, it was certainly understandable?
Frank, I'm going to say two things. One, I do not believe that. Not for an instant do I believe that there was nothing that could have been used militarily to respond to this in some way. That's the first thing. The second thing I would say then is if it is true, and again, I don't believe it is, but if it is true, then that says a lot about the posture of our military and the decline of our military under this current administration. And that's another issue that the Congress should be very concerned about. If our military is incapable of responding to a situation like that at a significant time like the anniversary of 9/11, then it says a lot about the degradation of our military and the state of readiness.
You and I have discussed this on many occasions, General Boykin, and I'm always grateful to you for your joining us to do so. But in no small measure, it seems to me that's probably a symptom of a military that has been systematically hollowed out with budget cuts and with social engineering of various kinds and with general, I think, as Bob Gates has pointed out, a lack of trust on the part of the President of the United States for the military. One manifestation of this that you have been very active in calling attention to and trying to seek corrections for partly perhaps because of your own distinguished service in the military, but also I know because of your being an ordained minister, is the extent to which religious freedom for our military personnel is being infringed upon. Could you talk a little bit about what's happening in that regard? And is that also kind of a symptom of this larger problem you're concerned about?
Well, it's a symptom of a larger problem in America. There is a severe attack on religious liberty, and that is directed against Christians. Remember that Islam is still a protected religion across America, but also in our military. But the infringement on the First Amendment rights of Christians in the military today is incredible. It's an unprecedented high. It is getting worse. And you're part of a coalition that we formed back in June to fight this. And I think we're seeing some success for our efforts. And now, why the military? And the reason is because you can't change America. You can't destroy faith in America unless you do that in the military, because the military is such an anchor of our society, and you have to go after the military. So when religious liberties are being infringed in the military, where people of the Christian faith cannot speak about their faith without fear of punishment, where Christian organizations, both evangelical and Catholic, are repeatedly and routinely identified as extremist. And people in those training sessions are told that if you're involved with these groups, you're going to be punished under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That is a very severe attack on religious liberty. But now, because of our coalition efforts, we've got a statement from the Secretary of the Army who has said, stop this training and do a complete review. We have a similar statement from the acting Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness that has said the same thing. And we have responses to letters we've written to them saying that this does not reflect DOD policy. Now, first of all, I think that it means that we've gotten their attention. But secondly, this is something that Americans all over the country need to be worried about, because this is the military your son and daughter is going to be serving in, or may be serving in today. And it is essential that while they protect our religious liberties, our First Amendment rights, theirs need to be protected, and it is the grassroots of America that has to step up to do that. So thank you for your efforts on this as well.
Well, the leadership that you've been providing is really critical, and I'm delighted to hear that there have been some acknowledgments that this needs attention from the senior ranks of the Pentagon. Let me turn to a related subject, General. Again, I know how deeply engaged you are in many of these contests, really, for the future of religious freedom in this country and religious practice, for that matter. Talk, if you would, a little bit about reports that a very significant effort is being made by enemies of Israel to bring to bear evangelicals in their support. In other words, in a sort of anti-Zionist effort. Is this of concern to you, and how serious a problem do you think it represents, not just for Israel, but for the religious community in this country?
Well, anti-Semitism is growing in America, and sadly, much of it is in the church. And I'm greatly disturbed by what I see with what is referred to as replacement theology, meaning from a theological perspective that there are more and more evangelicals that have adopted this theology that says that the Israel of the Bible, particularly of the book of Revelation, was replaced by the Christian church. That is that's anti-Semitism by another term. And I'm very concerned about that. Now listen, there's a history of this. And as much as we, you know, revere people like, you know, Martin Luther, the reality is that when he really started the Protestant Reformation, he was anti-Semitic. You know, the early popes had an anti-Semitic bent, if you will. And now that is resurfacing as we see more and more evangelicals and some Catholics that are beginning to say that the Israel of the Bible is really the modern-day Christian church, and that is just not sound theology. But the result of it is more and more people are not seeing the importance of modern-day Israel, and therefore not seeing the imperative for America to stand with Israel. You know, let me give you just one theological scriptural issue.
Very quickly, please.
Genesis 12:3 says that I will bless those who bless you, meaning Israel, and I will curse those who curse you. From a theological perspective, There is a biblical imperative for America to stand with Israel. And if we do not, the Bible tells us very clearly that there is a consequence to that.
Indeed.
So, John
Boykin,
I'm concerned about it.
We share your concern and appreciate your very clear message on this subject, as on all other things. Keep up the great work, sir, at the Family Research Council, where you are now the Executive Vice President, and come back to us again very soon. Next up, Ord Kidry, former State Department lawyer, gives us his perspective on this Iran deal and what's wrong with it, right after this.
To know what you think, leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
On August 2nd, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors.
Dedicated to supporting the troops and their family.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families. Retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Ord Kidry. He is a professor of law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He is also a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. And he brings a lot of very impressive professional credentials as an attorney and as an international legal practitioner in the Department of State under, successive presidents over quite a number of years. And it is for all of those reasons that we're delighted to welcome him back to Secure Freedom Radio to talk a little bit about the Iranian deal. Professor Kidry, glad to have you with us. Welcome. Happy New Year to you, sir.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you.
I'd like to get your professional judgment on this Iran deal. The president, the administration has made much of it. They have promised us that it is breaking the pursuit of nuclear weapons by Iran. It is setting the stage for a final agreement, which they are apparently going to be aggressively negotiating over the next 6 months to try to put all that to rest. And in exchange for it, as you know, they've made some rather important concessions, specifically with respect to something that FDD, Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has really been doing tremendously important work on, namely sanctions. So let's start with how effective you think this deal is in terms of slowing, let alone stopping, an Iranian nuclear weapon program.
The deal does slow a little bit, and in some ways, if the Iranians comply, which is a big if, would slightly roll back the Iranian program. People we work with, including David Albright and Ali Heineman, former Deputy Director General of the IAEA, have estimated that Iran's nuclear breakout time now, if Iran were to dash to a bomb now, it would take them about a month. Whereas if they comply with all elements of this deal, then 6 months from now, it would take them 2 months to dash to a bomb.
We're visiting with Ort Kidri. He is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And Professor Kidri, you were just describing a doubling of the lead time that it would take the Iranians to race to a bomb, if these outside experts are correct. Let me just ask you, one of the things that is worrying about this, an old boss of mine, Scoop Jackson, used to say, the trouble with this kind of deal is it's like the drunk looking for his dropped keys under the lamplight, because the light is better than where he actually dropped them some distance away. There seems to me to be a serious problem here whereby the Iranians have not put under international inspection, let alone limited activities, at all of the facilities they have, just some, a few of them at that. Does that trouble you that this may be much ado about not really very much if there are covert activities and covert facilities that are unchecked at all?
That is a major concern. It's one of several major concerns about this deal. One major concern about this deal is that the Iranians under this deal are going to be required to stop their production of 20% enriched uranium and to dilute some of it. But at the same time, the Iranians are basically unconstrained in their continued research on developing more efficient centrifuges for the future, and unconstrained with regard to their missile research, and largely unconstrained in terms of their research and development of nuclear warheads. So while in some senses the Iranians will be further behind in 6 months if they comply with this deal, in other ways they may be ahead.
Ort Kidri, talk a little bit, if you would, about who we're dealing with in these transactions, specifically Hassan Rouhani, the new president of Iran, who is the man whose ascendancy seems to have made all of this possible in the eyes of the Obama administration. Talk a little bit about what we know of his background, particularly his self-proclaimed snookering of the West in the past by buying time through these kinds of negotiations when he was the chief negotiator for Iran.
Absolutely. Rouhani was the chief negotiator for Iran right after the Gulf War, when Iran, for a variety of reasons, made a big show out of slowing their nuclear program. And there are speeches that have been uncovered since in which he explains that this was all a kind of a game in which Iran slowed some things and raced ahead on others, and Iran's nuclear program was, at the end of the day, he brags about this, that Iran's nuclear program at the end of the day was further ahead, that while he talked to Europeans, meanwhile, the program was advancing. And we have to be concerned that this may be what he's trying to do again.
And we've at least alluded to the fact that they've been given considerable concessions in the form of what I think of as life support for the regime. Your colleague at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, Mark Duberstein, has said that he believes that not just $7 billion may flow to the Iranians in this interim period, but maybe as much as $20 billion dollars. And others have said that the sanctions regime itself seems to be coming a cropper. Do you see it that way? And if so, might this really be more than just an environment in which they'll press ahead, but they'll benefit massively from this deal, the Iranians?
The administration has talked about this deal, the relief under it being worth $7 billion to the Iranians, but my colleague Mark Dubowitz and others have made the case that it's really more like $20 billion worth of relief. But even aside from the specifics of the relief, the sanctions are fraying. There have been a lot of articles about European businessmen see that the tide is turning vis-a-vis Iran, and they are starting to go into Iran to do business.
Ordu Kidri, let me just ask you, and again, you are a professor of law as well as an experienced international lawyer in the State Department, as well as a senior fellow at FDD. Talk a little bit about other things that the Iranian regime seems to be doing to, well, I would say rub our nose in the concessions, what Rouhani has himself called a surrender of the West to the great Iranian nation, specifically involving this fellow Imad Mughniyeh.
Yes. Iran's foreign minister, Zarif, on January 13th, one day after announcing the nuclear agreement with the U.S. and the rest of the P5+1, placed a wreath on the grave of Imad Mughniyeh, who had been a senior Hezbollah operative who died in December 2008. And Mughniyeh,
he was assassinated, as I recall, taken out, thank God.
He was taken out. Mughniyeh had masterminded the bombings of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, which killed 241, the U.S. embassy in Beirut, which killed 63, the bombings of the Israeli embassy in the Jewish Cultural Center in Argentina that killed 119. He had also held Westerners hostage in Lebanon. Why would Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif choose to lay a wreath on Mughniyeh's grave one day after agreeing to a nuclear deal with the U.S.? It was an extremely offensive act, simultaneously extremely offensive to the U.S., to France, whose troops had been killed by Mughniyeh, the Jewish community, the community of journalists. I'm concerned that this was a sign of insincerity about the deal, or a sign that Iran's support of deadly terrorism will continue even while Iran slows a bit its nuclear program. Certainly, it's an extremely worrisome indication that Iran isn't serious about rapprochement with the U.S.
No, it certainly seems that way. An expression of contempt, I think, is a distinct possible explanation. Certainly, as you've indicated, well, a sign to all of us that they are not to be trusted and that any rapprochement is likely to be unworthy of the paper on which it is inscribed. Professor Kidri, thank you for this quick review of this part of the battle space of what I think of as the war for the free world. We're very grateful to you for your expertise and your caution. We look forward to talking with you about it often in 2014. Keep up the good work at FDD and elsewhere, and God bless you, sir. Next up, Diana West on the Obama administration's deliberate blinding of our intelligence and law enforcement professionals against the threat we're facing and what it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last night, Fox News performed a real public service. It reported that America faces a possible existential threat if enemies or natural phenomena destroy the nation's electric grid. The report notes the danger of such an attack has been known for years, and if hostile powers don't subject us to grid-disrupting techniques like electromagnetic pulses, an intense solar storm is certain to do it, possibly in the very near future. Incredibly, the Pentagon responded with a statement that basically dismissed the EMP threat and declared that it is, quote, reckless and irresponsible, unquote, to do otherwise. In fact, nothing is more reckless and irresponsible than to suggest to the American people that there is no reason to worry about the peril of an essentially permanent loss of power. That's national security fraud. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Diana West, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. I'm very pleased to say a woman who is a syndicated columnist, the author of two absolutely superb books, most recently American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, and a sometime guest host for this program as well, Diana. I don't think I've had a chance to thank you on air for doing that for me last week or so. Appreciate enormously your help in all of these capacities and in these regards. Welcome back.
Delighted. Thank you, Frank.
I'd like to start talking with you today about Eric Holder. Eric Holder, of course, is the Attorney General of the United States and the man who it seems to have fallen to be kind of the pointy end of the spear for the Obama administration in much of what it is doing to embrace, legitimate, and otherwise embolden, I'm afraid, the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists. The most recent of these undertakings by the Attorney General was something that had to do with what the intelligence folks would call, I guess, indicators and warning for the purposes of law enforcement investigations aimed at countering terrorism and keeping us safe. Talk a little bit about what Holder's up to and how this fits into kind of the larger profile of what the administration is about.
This
is something that I'm surprised hasn't gotten more attention, and it could be we're just becoming more and more used to just truly reality-defying events that we don't pay attention anymore. But I know this would have hit people hard, for example, after 9/11, if the Attorney General had announced the Justice Department was banning racial profiling to bar federal agents from considering religion, national origin, gender from their list of criteria when trying to apprehend terrorists. This is where we are in 2014, and it's sort of a maybe it's a long time coming, but now that it's here, I'm not exactly sure we should all feel safe in our beds, because of course we have been in this past 12, now 13 years coming up, afraid, fearful, arming ourselves in both mentally and physically against terrorism emanating largely from the Islamic world. But now the Attorney General is telling us we cannot look at the Islamic world, we cannot look at men who are predominantly the vehicles of this, and we cannot look at nations of origin, even though, for example, we had 16 out of the 19 hijackers coming from Saudi Arabia, for example. So these are the types of markers that now federal agents are told they may not consider.
This is, of course, just the latest in a series of these sorts of, tying our hands behind our back, I guess, blindfolding ourselves, whatever you want to call it. Diana, the FBI's files have been purged, as have the militaries and the intelligence communities and DHSs and so on, of information that would help these first responder or these first line of defense, I should say, protect
us. Pre-responders,
exactly. And yet, you know, that has clearly complicated the effort to prepare them to deal with these sorts of threats. Then there was the promulgation of guidelines that said if you're going to do any training from now on, you have to get effectively the permission of organizations like the Council on American Islamic Relations and other Muslim Brotherhood front organizations. Now there's this. You're not allowed to even try to discern the obvious threat axes, if you will. It must be obvious to most people, but it certainly seems to be escaping the U.S. government that we are creating conditions which will make it very difficult indeed to protect the American people.
Well, that's what this is all about, and I guess it goes back even farther, of course, as we've talked about. It does go back to the Bush administration, for sure, where we see the first real institutional elimination of the language by which we try to understand these things when Bush guidelines came out, eliminating words like jihad, Islamic jihad, caliphate, and so on from the lexicon of public officials. So once you actually start stripping away the language, you are starting to condition the thinking. This is something that, you know, I go into at great length in American Betrayal because we've seen it before. It comes right out of Marxist dialectics that teach people not to think about things or to think about things in a certain way. And so when language is controlled, thought is controlled. So now we are seeing the increasing strangulation, really, of logic and reality itself. And this becomes very dangerous when you are trying to be the protector of a country and its constitution. And this is why this is so alarming. But again, I think we're also seeing in the sense that people are not, you know, taking to the streets over this, I think we are seeing the effect of years and years of this kind of conditioning on us all, which we, you know, can think about in terms of what the very famous frog of Malcolm Muggeridge, I believe it was, that is slowly boiled, so slowly boiled as pot that it doesn't know and it's been boiled to death. And I think we are somewhere down the road with that frog.
The boil is underway. Diana West, let me talk about, in the remaining time with you, several things that are kind of interconnected with this, and really they all touch in a way on the thesis of American Betrayal, your marvelous new bestseller. You know, this is translating into perilous conditions for those of us who love freedom and want to live in liberty. I was reminded of this by a piece that you've posted in your DianaWest.net blog about what you call the aftermath of Iraq in Colorado. Talk a little bit about that episode, and maybe we can back the lens up and see how it fits into this larger paradigm of growing danger here at home as well as elsewhere.
It's quite a startling case that is not getting national attention. This is a local Colorado story that is a rape and assault case that happened in 2012. Five Iraqi men in their early 20s were arrested in 2012. The final defendant in this case is coming to trial this month. That is what is current about the story. What struck me in finally being able to read about it and look into it is that these five young Iraqi men in Colorado Springs, one of whom has been convicted of the rape of the assault, one is currently up on terrible charges. Three have been convicted of misdemeanors involved, accessory charges, lying to police, and so on. These are all young men who were brought here, sponsored by members of the United States military for services rendered, yes, in Iraq, early in the war. These were young teenagers. One was as young as 11 when he began working with Americans, translating, helping identify enemies. The final defendant now, a man named Jassim Ramadan, actually identified his own father to the Americans. His father was a Saddam Hussein military officer and loyalist early on in the invasion, and then ended up being sponsored and indeed the subject of a book by First Sergeant Daniel Hendricks, who promised this young man, promised him he would get him out of Iraq, get him into the United States, and indeed he did. And when you look at the story of this terrible trial, this terrible crime, all five of these young men were sponsored by other members of the United States military. So this to me is why it relates to Iraq, why it relates directly to the war, and also fits in kind of with this terrible sense of how could this have happened, which again comes back to something we discuss quite often, willful blindness, about cultural difference, about terrible clash between our systems. It isn't just a day that every single Iraqi interpreter who comes to this country or immigrant who comes to this country is going to end up in a rape trial, but there are these terrible fundamental differences that are not taken into account when policy is made. And when you look at five of these interpreters being brought here sponsored for visas, you're looking at a policy, a very important story.
Willful blindness abounds. And you know, this reminds me of something I read with horror, written by Soren Kern at the Gatestone Institute at the end of last year. We won't have time to get into this in detail today, but maybe another time, Diana. But a judge in the United Kingdom, whose trajectory Soren has done a marvelous job of chronicling as it becomes increasingly Islamicized and submits, as I fear we are as well, he's warned from the bench, women may not safely or should not assume they can safely take taxicabs in the United Kingdom driven by Muslim cab drivers because there is now such a rampant degree of rape at the hands of such men taking place. It's just staggering. The sort of cultural as well as societal phenomenon that nobody covers better than you do, Diana West. I appreciate you spending some time with us to discuss it each week. We'll look forward to doing it again with you next week. Next up, Christian Whiten joins us to talk about Ukraine and the NSA and much more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes
to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Christian Whiten. He is a man of many parts, having served with distinction in the senior ranks of the State Department under George W. Bush. He currently contributes mightily to the national and international debate in outlets like Fox News and various periodicals. He is also the author of a terrific new book, Smart Power, Between Diplomacy and War. Christian Whiten, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us. I think it's a happy new year to you. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here. Happy new year.
We're listening with growing concern, I think many of us, about to what's happening in Ukraine, a country that broke free of the Soviet orbit and managed for a time to have a vibrant democracy. I think you were in the State Department at critical moments along that trajectory. It seems to be sliding back into the thrall of Vladimir Putin. And I'd want to get your sense of what's happening on the ground there at the moment, Christian, and where you think this is likely to hit.
Frank, well, it does seem that the situation is getting more and more out of hand. You had this attempt by Yanukovych, who, you know, these names just keep going around and around, sort of like Putin in Russia, because there was this Orange Revolution in 2004, 2005 that removed him and put in power a real democracy and a more pro-Western democracy. He came back, sort of typical case of more liberal and pro-American forces being worse organized than the more pro-Russian or pro-Islamist in other parts of the world forces. And, you know, he's back and attempted to, you know, turn away from a economic arrangement with the EU he had negotiated and turn more towards Putin's Russia. Ukrainians rose up, and now you have this level of violence. And, you know, someone who observes democracy movements, movements against repressive states, that you're always very concerned when they turn violent, because often that is the precursor and justification that the government then uses to crack down on those democracy forces.
Indeed. And that seems to be happening at the moment, at the very least the violence. And again, as you say, it is often used as a pretext. Sometimes it is instigated clandestinely by the government seeking to engage in such a crackdown. Do you think that's happening in Ukraine? And again, Christian Whiteman, does this likely conduce to a further consolidation of power by the most ruthless sorts, Yanukovych and the pro-Kremlin types around him?
I think it does. Unfortunately, you know, you do have a large number of people, especially in the western part of Ukraine, who want integration with Europe, who want to be closer to the more vibrant and freer world than to Vladimir Putin's Russia. But
and that's what set this off in the beginning, wasn't it? It was there was a deal on the table that Yanukovych was supposed to sign off on that would have done just that, but balked at the last moment, right?
Exactly. And it's something his own government had negotiated. And you sort of wonder what deals went on behind the scenes, threats and inducements from Putin. You know, Yanukovych ultimately is a bit of a thug. He was convicted of a number of crimes, including rape, as a younger man. It doesn't surprise me at all that he may be engaging in sort of false flag violence that is aimed at making the opposition, the democratic opposition, look violent when in fact it is not.
And we know something, actually, of the terms that Putin gave out, and I don't remember them off the top of my head, but as I recall, when this deal came a cropper, there was money coming in from Russia, quite a lot of it, as a matter of fact, and promises of cheaper gas to be supplied from Russia, an energy weapon that Putin has used in the past to try to bring the Ukrainians to heel. Do we know, Christian, much about exactly what price Yanukovych sold his country out for?
Right. Well, I don't think it was for a job at Gazprom, as Germany's former leader was offered. But
another distinguished former leader, right?
Yes, that's right. But as you point out, with the price of energy, it's not really set at market prices, because you have the legacy energy sector and distribution grid of the Soviet Union. Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. So typically, you have long-term arrangements for providing natural gas from Russia. And what Putin has done is has used this as a weapon, as you point out, threatening especially the Ukraine, but all of the rest of Europe. It's a reason why the United States in the Clinton and Bush administrations at least really wanted to help European governments and other governments get free of, and in fact, this goes back to the Reagan administration, get free of Russian energy. Yeah. But that's gone by the wayside, unfortunately.
Yeah, as I fear, as freedom in Ukraine. We'll be holding our breath and hoping for the best. Christian Whiteman, let me turn to a different subject, not altogether unrelated. We're all interested in understanding threats as they are emerging around the world. Some of them, I think it's fair to say, even countries that we think of as friendly or even allies may be abetting covertly, clandestinely, as I say. What do you make of the president's pronouncement last Friday that there will be henceforth no National Security Agency monitoring of the conversations of leaders of so-called friendly and allied countries? And does that likely mean that we are exposing ourselves, as we were talking about with Diana West previously, to a degree of willful blindness that could cost us dearly?
Yeah, I think that is the case. You know, there are some countries on whom we do not spy. We have no spy agreements with Great Britain, with Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, because we are very close with them, English-speaking democracies. Also, the world was sort of cut into regions after World War II for the collection of signals intelligence. And all of those countries are integral to that, and we share. And actually, the lack of any revelations about spying on them shows the NSA is following the rules that have been set for it. But there are other countries, and I don't think we should extend that protection to them. France and Germany, I mean, France is an avid collector of intelligence on the United States. And Germany, setting aside from the fact that it started two world wars in the last century, is critically important today. It's the lender of last resort in Europe. It's kept the European economy afloat. We cannot afford to wait until we read things in Spiegel, if they ever make it that far. I mean, anything Angela Merkel said into her cell phone was picked up not just potentially by us, and I don't know if we really did, but if we did, and I hope we did, you can also bet the Russians were picking it up and the Chinese were picking it up. And the question is, do we want to know at least as much as the Chinese and Russians? And that's, I think, true for all of these leaders.
Yeah. And you know, to your point, to the extent that Germany, between the times when it set in train horrific global conflagrations, actually was aiding and abetting the Soviet Union. Angela Merkel was, of course, in East Germany at the time, and maybe rather more sensitive to this history than others. But still, the relationship with the Russians, especially at a moment where, as we were just discussing, Christian Whetton, they are perfectly capable of using energy as a weapon against our allies in Europe. These are the sorts of conversations, perhaps not Angela Merkel's, you know, conversations with her intimate circle and family, but certainly with hostile powers, increasingly hostile powers like Vladimir Putin's Russia.
Right. And even the last decade, you remember with the Iraq War, and whether you're in favor or against the Iraq War, you know, it's important to remember that France and Germany, two NATO allies, weren't just opposed and weren't just unhelpful, but were integral in organizing an anti-American coalition. Egging on opponents, including Turkey, which then didn't allow U.S. troops to flow through. It wasn't solely France and Germany's responsibility, but things that increased the risk to the lives of our troops, which I think we're all in favor of, regardless of whether we view on that war. And so, again, these are just countries where we have to know, if we want to be secure, we have to know what they know and what they're thinking. And frankly, you know, we need to have these electronic capabilities because our Congress and people here have done so much to diminish our human intelligence gathering.
Indeed. And, you know, you mentioned Turkey as a case in point. The president thinks of Tayyip Erdogan as one of his best friends among international leaders. This is a guy who I believe very strongly has done incalculable harm to our alliance with Turkey, with Turkey itself, and certainly has enabled and abetted our enemies. A subject for a longer conversation, particularly the bit about other foreign nationals that the president has also extended privacy rights to. We'll visit with you, I hope, about that very soon. Thank you very much, Christian Whetton, for the work you do with us and elsewhere. Keep it up. We'll talk with you in the near future, and I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.